The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 7th, 2018. It's a special edition, one might say an emergency edition. The Democrats took the House last night, and today Jeff Sessions was fired by President Trump. And his chief of staff, Matt Whitaker, was installed as acting attorney general, which means that Mr. Whitaker has supervisory authority over Bob Mueller's investigation, which had been being supervised by Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general. There's a lot to go over. And with me on a conference line is Susan Hennessy, Chuck Rosenberg, Steve Vladek, Bob Bauer, and Paul Rosenzweig, none of whom need any introduction to Lawfare listeners. So I won't give much of one, except to say that there is a amazing reservoir of experience and knowledge here. So let's start. Susan, get us started. What should we make? How big a surprise is this? How anxious are you about the events that transpired today?
So I am going to stake out a position pretty far on the ledge, and I'm hoping that maybe others on the call will seek to walk me back. This strikes me as really serious and a really dangerous moment. And so the way I perceive the current situation is effectively we have a Trump loyalist overseeing the Mueller investigation. You have an individual who I think there is strong evidence was selected because of his publicly stated hostility to the Mueller investigation. And so I do think that we are in a situation in which it is plausible either that this is somebody who's going to take the kind of step like firing Mueller or ending the investigation, or this is someone who is going to exercise oversight authority as the acting attorney general in ways that are designed to substantially impede this investigation. So I really do think that this is kind of the crisis moment that people have been worrying about for a long time.
All right. So, Chuck, the other day on MSNBC, Nicole Wallace referred to you as human Xanax, which means that if anybody can talk Susan down here, it's got to be you. Do you see the matter in a less alarmed light than she does?
Only maybe, Ben. I hope. Because there's such a strong gravitational pull within the Department of Justice towards norms and the rule of law that Matt Whitaker can rise to the occasion. I fear, and so this may not help Susan that much, that he was put there precisely for the reason she articulated. Imagine that the Trump administration would have another attorney general who would recuse himself or who wouldn't, as Matt Whitaker previously wrote, view a financial investigation of the Trump organization and of Trump himself as a red line. And so I am sort of torn between what I hope and what I fear. I'm not sure I did Susan any good.
Steve, you have written a great deal about the question of who can legally serve in the position to which Whitaker has been installed. And my read is that, you'll walk through the legality of it, but am I wrong that whatever question there would have been had the president simply fired Sessions and installed Whitaker, by asking for and receiving Sessions' resignation, which is the specific modality by which the White House did this, they've probably cured any problem that they would have under the Federal Vacancies Reform Act with respect to Whitaker?
So I think, Ben, you're half right and half wrong. I think they've certainly gone a long way toward solving one of the problems under the Vacancies Reform Act. I think the other problem is less of a problem, as I'll try to elaborate. So under the ordinary DOJ succession statute, when there's a vacancy in the office of the Attorney General, the Deputy Attorney General, so long as he or she is Senate confirmed, automatically becomes the acting Attorney General. That's exactly why Rod Rosenstein was supervising Mueller in the first place. He was supervising him not as Deputy Attorney General, but in his capacity as acting Attorney General, because Sessions had recused on the Russia investigation. The Federal Vacancies Reform Act provides alternative mechanisms for filling a vacancy in these kinds of federal offices, so long as the vacancy is created by death, resignation, or the office holder being otherwise unable to discharge the duties of the office. Ben, as you alluded to, there is a long-running question about whether that consciously omits vacancies created by firing. And the reason why this matters is because whereas the DOJ succession statute says it's, the next in line is Rosenstein, next after him is the Associate Attorney General, which is currently vacant, and then Francisco, the Federal Vacancies Reform Act creates more possibilities. Under the Federal Vacancies Reform Act, the president can choose either that person, the person who's next in line, or any other Senate-confirmed official anywhere in the executive branch, or a wide range of non-Senate-confirmed senior officials in the relevant department who have held their current position and been at that department for at least 90 days. And it's that third category, it's 5 U.S.C. 3345A3, that covers Chris Whitaker. So I think it's certainly true that had Sessions clearly been fired, there would have been a huge dispute and almost certainly litigation over whether the president could use the Federal Vacancies Reform Act. We saw a little bit of this earlier this year with the VA secretary when the president fired Secretary Shulkin and then turned around and tried to argue that Shulkin had resigned. There was a lawsuit filed over that, but it actually was dismissed when the acting successor was replaced by a full-time confirmed successor. So I guess this is a long way of saying that I do think that the text of Attorney General Sessions' letter, where he says, "At your request, I have resigned," probably settles the question of whether that satisfies the Vacancies Reform Act. I should say there are plenty of people online arguing that it's a constructive firing because, he knew that the president was going to fire him anyway and because he was resigning at the president's request. I must confess that I don't find that argument convincing because Sessions could have refused to resign, could have forced the president to fire him, and indeed is surely well aware of all of this and still wrote a letter where he said, "I resign." So I think that issue is now off the table. The lingering issue is whether the Vacancies Reform Act is somehow superseded as a statute of general applicability by the more specific DOJ succession statute, 28 U.S.C. Section 508. This has never been litigated. There's a 2007 opinion by the Office of Legal Counsel that concludes that the answer is no, that the Vacancies Reform Act coexists and operates alongside the DOJ succession statute, such that the president's allowed to choose, especially in cases where the office becomes vacant by resignation, which of those statutory regimes to use. So I know that was long-winded, Ben, but my gut reaction here is because Sessions said he was resigning, and because I think OLC's analysis in their 2007 opinion
about the relationship between the Vacancies Reform Act and the DOJ succession statute is probably correct and certainly enough to convince a court. I don't think there's going to be a meritorious legal challenge to the appointment of Matt Whitaker as the acting attorney general. That doesn't mean people won't try it, but I think it will lose if we see it.
All right. So I want to try to make the argument that this is all less alarming than Susan suggests and Chuck doesn't talk her out of. We all expected yesterday that Sessions would be removed or would resign immediately after the midterms, and that has been sort of the common wisdom for a long time. Trump has all but said it publicly. And so what happened today was essentially exactly what we were expecting, with the proviso that it was done in a somewhat aggressive fashion in terms of naming Whitaker rather than simply letting Rod Rosenstein act while somebody was nominated and confirmed. And so my question, Bob, is, you know, and I'm asking this, I have to say I'm arguing contra my own belief here, but I'm interested in your sense, like, isn't what happened today exactly what we expected to happen? And therefore, you know, if we weren't alarmed about it yesterday, why should we be having an emergency podcast about it today?
We might have expected it and still be alarmed about the possibility. So I want to say that at the outset. The other piece of this is the timing and the press conference he held earlier in the day. And there, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to articulate sort of on Trump's behalf what he might have been thinking here. But bear in mind, he had a lot to say today about what it would mean if the Democrats attempted to investigate him. And I think he's playing on the notion that the Democrats will do themselves no favor if they come charging out of the box, having gained a majority in the House, with a lot of aggressive investigative and oversight activity. In some sense, what he did today was to attempt to force their hand a little bit by engaging, as you correctly said, in a very aggressive step here, because there was an alternative available to him that didn't so obviously displace Rosenstein. And I think that in some sense, he's daring the Democrats to fight him over it. And it's a dispute that he would like to have, perhaps. And I'm not saying, by the way, he's rationally thinking through all these strategies, maybe more sort of a feral instinct. It may be just impulse. Maybe that today he's just angry at CNN. Whatever the reasons are, now the Democrats in the House are facing a very, very heated controversy about what he intends with this step and what's going to happen next. And he may think he's put them in a tight spot because he's, in effect, giving them the choice of reacting strongly to this or stepping back from it because they didn't want, in fact, to portray themselves in the first instance, having attained the majority, as going immediately on the offensive on this issue. So to answer your question, I'll bring it to a conclusion by saying I think there's reason to believe that he is planning to really mix it up on this issue very aggressively. And he thought his time had come today. In that sense, I think, yes, we'd have some reason to be alarmed.
Okay, so Paul, I want to think through this from the point of view of Bob Mueller, who, as Bob notes, you know, may well be alarmed by this, but can't possibly be surprised, and has had I think the technical term is a shitload of time to prepare for this, given that the president has been threatening to fire Jeff Sessions for, you know, close to 16 months now or maybe more. And so what does – if you're sitting in Bob Mueller's shoes and you have had a lot of time to prepare for this, including, by the way, a Washington Post story some time back that specifically named Matt Whitaker as the president, the person the president wants to install above you. What is Bob Mueller What is he thinking now, and how has he, in your judgment, kind of prepared for this moment, given that he, you know, can't possibly be surprised by it?
Well, I've been thinking about that a lot all today and for the last few weeks. First off, I think that Mueller is going to at least start publicly by indulging the assumption that Whitaker intends him no harm, that Whitaker will act in good faith, as he has said in his first statement he will do, to bring honor to the department, and that nothing will change.
And why, if you were Mueller, why would you indulge that assumption in the first instance, given the things that Whitaker has said, including said about you?
Well, two reasons. The first is that from what little I know of Mueller, that's kind of his natural instinct, is to assume that the process will work until it doesn't, right? And he is a creature of the department and of the government as a functioning entity. And so he will try hard to stay within that, I think. And the second, more systematically, which is sort of where I was going with this, is that I think he benefits from Whitaker firing the first shot, right? He will not want to act preemptively in anticipating bad faith on Whitaker's part. He will want to act responsibly and proportionately. In doing that, he'll have taken a number of steps. I mean, quite obviously, he'll have protected the substance of his investigation against seizure. Back in the Watergate days, they actually took steps to make sure that all their documents were secure. That's far easier now in a digital age. I would be unsurprised if there weren't copies of everything he has all around. I am reasonably sure that to the extent that he feels as though he's reached a relative conclusion as to some of the issues, that is as canned as he can make it, to go as quickly as he possibly can with it. And it too may be secreted in safe places for provision, say, to the Democrats in the House upon subpoena. The third and more aggressive thing is, I anticipate that he will have advanced his timing as far and as fast as he can. Before the midterms, he was investigating at a quick pace, but not one that had a sense of extremity and urgency. But since the time he went dark 6, 7, 8 weeks ago with his last public activity, I expect that he has done everything possible to be prepared for whatever it is he feels he has sufficient evidence to move forward with in public settings, whether that's, you know, there are sealed indictments awaiting unsealing or indictments awaiting immediate presentation. I don't know, because he's quite closed-mouthed, of course, as to the substance of this. But he may very well be ready to act, and assuming that the first act from Whitaker will not be an absolute standstill, shut down, do nothing now, which would stop him, but some warning shot to which he can react with some public activity that challenges the good faith of any further steps by Whitaker.
Okay, so let's go back to Susan, the place where Susan started. Do you think Paul, speaking in the voice of Bob Mueller there, is wrong to go into this with an assumption of good faith on Whitaker's part? And, should he walk in with the assumption that this is, a person who has made his views about the investigation very clear in repeated public statements, in tweets, in an op-ed on CNN, who is a personal friend of one of the witnesses in the investigation, Sam Clovis, who was the chairman of Sam Clovis's political campaign in 2014. And, you know, that Mueller's assumption walking in should be, you know, it's good to meet you. Your recusal is expected.
So I think there's a difference between the sort of strategic and procedural presumption of good faith and an actual presumption of good faith. So I think Paul's absolutely right that Mueller likely will and certainly should, allow Whitaker to fire the first shot or engage with sort of the process in good faith. I think that's a separate question from whether or not the rest of us should sort of suspend disbelief and say, oh, well, you know, maybe he'll be transformed by having sworn, you know, his oath of office. I do think that there is one thing that Mueller has here that is potentially quite significant, and that's the FBI director, Christopher Wray. So, Wray has, I think, demonstrated himself to be a responsible and good faith actor throughout the course of this investigation. And it is a different dynamic and a different scenario if it's just Mueller and the acting attorney general. And there's a question about whether or not information is going to get out, or whether or not the investigation is going to be sort of secretly impeded. I do think the presence of the FBI director, an individual who's going to have insight into every part of this investigation as well, potentially does act as a pretty powerful incentive, even for somebody who isn't operating in good faith. And I confess, I don't extend the benefit of the doubt to Whitaker, or certainly not to the president. I think he selected him for bad faith reasons. But it does sort of incentivize Whitaker to engage in sort of a process of strategic good faith. And that itself is something that, is a substantial constraint and an important one.
So this is Steve. I agree with everything Susan just said. I have a sort of one or two, I guess, additional thoughts that lead me to conclude that maybe we're not quite at the, you know, taking to the streets moment just yet. It's possible that a month from now, we will have heard nothing further about, you know, the relationship between the acting attorney general and special counsel Mueller. It's possible that the president's going to move fairly quickly to name a permanent replacement for Attorney General Sessions, which I think would be a sign that, you know, Whitaker really is just there as a temporary placeholder, as opposed to, for example, Mick Mulvaney, who's been the acting director of the CFPB seemingly in perpetuity now. And also, I mean, I think it's worth stressing that, you know, one of the biggest moments in the whole Mueller investigation may be taking place tomorrow, on Thursday morning, when a 3-judge panel of the D.C. Circuit is going to hear Andrew Miller's appeal, his contempt citation, which is basically a, you know, broad-based challenge to the validity of Mueller's appointment, to the validity of the investigation, and a pretty powerful opportunity for the D.C. Circuit to say, you know, all of this is legal and constitutional and, you know, give its blessing to what Mueller's been doing. In those circumstances, I guess, you know, my reaction is to sort of be worried about the situation, but not yet panic. But it's sort of akin to, you know, taking off your seatbelt while driving, but we haven't yet crashed the car. And in that regard, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's worth stressing that, you know, back in April, the Senate Judiciary Committee passed on a bipartisan vote legislation that actually would have made it harder for an acting attorney general or a Senate confirmed attorney general to fire the special counsel without good cause. Interesting to see today, you know, statements from Senator Susan Collins, Senator Lamar Alexander, I give him less credit, but Senator Jeff Flake, that, you know, they're going to be watching this carefully, that the, you know, the new acting attorney general should not interfere with special counsel Mueller. Flake even said we should bring the special counsel protection bill to a vote on the floor. So all that leads me to think that, like, yes, this is a moment to be wary, and yes, there are lots of reasons not to trust the relevant decision makers in this operation. But I guess, you know, I'm willing to not give anyone the benefit of the doubt so much as at least allow for the possibility that Sessions was always going to be replaced after the midterms, that this is the president moving expeditiously, perhaps without regard to the Mueller investigation, And that, you know, we're all just paranoid because the president's done nothing over the last, you know, 19, 20 months to gain any of our trust. And I guess, you know, that's my more optimistic, cautiously optimistic, or at least not yet panicking take.
All right. So, Chuck, we have an interesting thesis here from Paul that Bob Mueller's strategic posture toward Matt Whitaker will be to assume good faith in order to either have him behave appropriately or have him strike the first blow, because that would be strategically advantageous to him. So you worked for Bob Mueller, and I think, I'm not sure about this, but I think you also overlapped at DOJ with Matt Whitaker when he was a U.S. attorney in Iowa. So I'm just curious for your sense of like what the play of Mueller is toward this guy. Does he look at him and say, wow, he's said all these things about me? The right move is to say to him, look, sir, it's good to meet you, but I really think you need to recuse yourself here. Or does he look at him and say, that's up to him to decide. My role is to assume that whoever I'm reporting to is doing their job, and I will deal with the situation that I'm impeded at that moment that I am.
Well, let me answer the second question first. And you're right, Ben, I did work for Bob Mueller, which was and is one of the great professional privileges of my entire life. Matt Whitaker and I both served simultaneously as United States attorneys, he in Iowa, me in Eastern District of Virginia.
And let me pause you there. What do you think of him?
I don't know Matt terribly well. So, you know, not really inclined to travel down that path, but I will say that I have the utmost respect for Bob Mueller and leave it at that. With that, I am sort of inclined to believe that Bob Mueller is a by-the-book, assuming folks are going to do their job kind of guy. And so he's not going to walk in looking for a fight. He's going to walk in as a Marine officer with a superior officer at the table and give him every courtesy that he's entitled to. He's going to brief him as he would brief Rod Rosenstein or anyone else who was in a position supervising his investigation. That said, I think this is an important point. It touches on something Paul said and on something that Stephen said. Whatever may happen to Bob Mueller, and I hope it's nothing bad, there are a set of facts that exist in this investigation. There are documents, there are emails, there are bank records, there are phone records, there's testimony already preserved in the grand jury, all of which exists, and nobody, no president, no person can simply make it disappear. So let's assume that Matt Whitaker either rises to the occasion or that the things he said that were arguably dismissive of the case, in fact, I think worse than dismissive, were said in ignorance before he actually knew what the facts were, that Mueller is going to educate him on that, and that he perhaps rises to the occasion. And if he doesn't, if he turns out to be the disappointment that we fear he might be, those facts still exist. Prosecutors all over the United States know what to do with those facts. And so even if Mueller is fired, even if they try and shut him down by stepping on his budget, I believe there's still a case out there, and it will be made. Whatever the facts are, they will be found and they will be followed. And that may seem Pollyannish, but I believe it.
Ben, this is Paul. Just to follow up, I mean, some of the most significant parts of this investigation have already been hived off to, for example, the Southern District of New York, which is the far more likely locus of the Trump Organization financial side of any investigation. And it would take a really significant breach of procedure and decorum for Whitaker to not only shut down the Mueller investigation, but also to direct the Southern District of New York to cease and desist as well. So I'm sort of in agreement that that you can't put this genie fully back in the bottle, no matter how much President Trump might want it, and no matter how much Mr. Whitaker might try and accommodate President Trump.
And especially, I mean, Paul, and especially with the Democrats retaking control of the House, because
yes,
the one thing that will absolutely happen on, you know, at 1 p.m. on January 3rd, if Mueller is fired between now and then, is, you know, multiple House committees fighting over who will have jurisdiction to basically, you know, call him first and find out what he knows.
Okay, I'm going to come back to Congress in a minute, but I want to finish up with the executive branch side first. Bob, I'm interested in the White House side of this. There were repeated efforts to do this during Mr. McGahn's tenure. He seems to have thwarted them or talked the president out of them. You've spent a lot of time musing over the role of Don McGahn for obvious reasons. I'm curious whether the fact that this happened today, we should understand kind of purely as a midterm thing, or is this like the missing steady hand of Don McGahn is on display today when, you know, the thing that the president has wanted to do but that McGahn had restrained him from, actually McGahn is now gone and the president goes ahead and does it?
It probably helped that he didn't have, that we know of, a dissenting voice. And also, I don't know whether Pat Cipollone is installed yet as White House counsel. My understanding is that at least in these matters, Emmett Flood continues to serve and that the Cipollone clearance process isn't complete. But I could be wrong about that. But if that's true, that means that, and again, without knowing precisely what position Flood may have taken and whatever, but there's some instability in that space. There's no permanent White House counsel yet in place, fully briefed and ready to weigh in effectively on these decisions. So to the extent that one imagines that that would have made a difference in the conversation, yeah, that's certainly absent here. So it might have made life easier for him, or it's one less argument he had to have, since he was known to have had some very ferocious arguments with Don McGahn. There's one more point I want to make about Mueller's role. I just wanted to address the question of what Mueller's play is. I want to just piggyback on a couple of points that have been made. I think his play is to continue to do exactly what he's done and play it straight. And at the end of the day, it's going to fall to other institutional actors to do what it is that's necessary to protect his position and to protect the fruits of the investigation. That's the House. And of course, to the extent that Congress acts to protect the special counsel, or for that matter, to unleash holy hell if the special counsel is fired, it falls to Congress as a whole to do that. And I think Mueller has to simply perform within his institutional role. An example would be, since we're talking about steps that Whitaker could conceivably take to complicate matters, an example would be if Whitaker were to say early on in some context, there will be no roadmap. And this is the kind of report that I expect in the most limited form within, in my reading of the special counsel regulations, that you will provide at the conclusion of this investigation to the Deputy Attorney General. And it seems to me that the answer to that is not for Mueller to figure out a way around it, but for the institutional actors to make sure, for example, Congress, that it takes the step that it can take to obtain the grand jury material by application to the court. Or for the Congress to take the steps that it needs to take to protect Bob Mueller's liberty of action here, professional discretion. I don't think it falls to Mueller to kind of find some way to force the recusal decision or essentially sort of unilaterally save the republic.
So let me get this straight. You're saying that there is no special preparations that Mueller is likely to have made for this moment. There's no, you know, doomsday device that Mueller's name is on. There's just, we're going to plow ahead in the straightest of straight arrow kinds of ways until somebody stops us. And at that point, we'll deal with it then.
Yes, I'm saying he continues to do what has served him extremely well and what I think has distinguished him in a whole range of ways from, say, the Starr experience, is that he has played this by the book from all appearances. And I think that's, for a whole host of reasons, what he needs to continue to do to preserve the credibility of all his efforts to date and for whatever follows. And I think that he should not attempt, and I don't think he's inclined to attempt, from anything I've seen — others know him better in this context than I do — to, in effect, through one strategic ploy or the other, to compensate for the failure of other institutional actors to do what they lawfully can do and should do.
Chuck, do you buy that? Do you think he's made no particular arrangements for this and he's just, you know, plowing ahead with the straight by the book thing, and that's the source of his legitimacy?
Well, I don't think they're mutually exclusive, Ben. I think Bob is right. The Bob Mueller I know and the Bob Mueller I work for is a by the book guy, right? He is going to brief the attorney general because that's his job. He's going to withhold nothing because that's how he operates. Having said that, I think there are preparations, and we've already discussed them on this phone call, including the fact that pieces of this case are now elsewhere, in the Southern District of New York, in the District of Columbia, and in the Eastern District of Virginia. And to my way of thinking, those are preparations in case something bad happens. It's also logically pieces of the case that were properly spun off. But again, I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive. And I think when it comes to interacting with other players and other institutions and other branches of government, Bob is right. Bob Bauer is right. And Bob Mueller will do it by the book.
Okay, so I want to, before we go to Congress, I want to address the recusal question for Whitaker head on. I read those statements that he made and read his about his apparent relationship with Sam Clovis, and I don't actually understand how he doesn't recuse here. So, you know, I'm curious, do any of you have a background in a sufficient background in the Justice Department's recusal rules to, you know, give me a sense of, like, is there any serious question that he cannot properly supervise this investigation?
Well, I'm not going to pretend that it's been recently, though I've read them before, that I've looked at recusal regs, but it does seem to me that if and I don't also want to add, I want to add by way of qualification that I haven't looked deeply into the facts of all of the disqualifying features here, but it does seem to me that just on what I know, if these are regulations, as I believe they are, that turn also on the question of appearances, then yes, it seems to me that there's a clear question of recusal presented. Whether how powerful that is, I wouldn't be in position to opine on that at the moment.
Can I ask sort of a refinement question on that? And that's that, is there any argument that he is not obligated to seek an ethics opinion, right? So with Rod Rosenstein, one of the questions that came up was, well, why wasn't he recused, right? He was potentially a witness. The thing that I think cured that was reporting that said that Rod Rosenstein had sought an ethics opinion on the question, and that career DOJ attorneys had determined, no, he was not required, that he was not required to recuse. So one of the things I'm looking for sort of from the outside is whether or not there's an indication of a process being followed. But is my sense that that process is obligatory in the first instance? Is that right?
Yeah. So Chuck, you've been a U.S. attorney. When we, you know, when there's a bunch of newspaper stories that says the head of the office has publicly commented on the actual investigation in question, and by the way, ran the campaign for one of the witnesses in question, who described him the day of his appointment as a friend. What does that trigger anything as an automatic matter, or is it just up to the individual whether to, you know, ask the ethics lawyers, what do I have to do in this situation?
So in the ordinary case, and I recognize there's nothing ordinary about this particular case, in the ordinary case, the federal prosecutor, the assistant U.S. attorney, which is what I was for a long time, or the U.S. attorney, would take himself or herself out of it. Or if unsure what to do, they would seek the opinion of PREO, the Professional Responsibility Advisory Office at the Department of Justice. Or they would go to one of the ethics officials in their own district. Every district in the country has their own ethics officials, people designated to give advice on these types of matters. But it's always, in my experience, self-initiated, right? We are the ones who know that, you know, our sister-in-law works for a particular company that's under investigation, or we own stock in a particular company that's under investigation, or we were college friends with somebody who's the subject of this investigation. So typically, it's on the prosecutor to flag it and to act on it, and if unsure what to do, to seek advice. Here, obviously, it's different. A lot of us can flag for Matt Whitaker what the problem may be. And by the way, let me add one other thing to the mix, Ben, while I'm at it. We were concerned, obviously, that Rod Rosenstein might be a witness in this investigation because he wrote the memo that was used to justify the firing of Jim Comey. Well, wouldn't any good prosecutor want to know why Matt Whitaker was picked to act as attorney general in this investigation, given what he's already said about the investigation to CNN and elsewhere? Why isn't he a witness? I don't mean that he has obstructed justice. I don't mean that there was a quid pro quo. I simply mean to say that Mueller would have to want to know why Whitaker was picked for this job. So isn't he a witness potentially as well?
So let me hop in here and offer a different take on Susan's question. As far as I know, Susan, there is no obligatory internal ethics process that Whitaker must undertake in order to justify it. It is preventative, it's precatory, and it's advisory only. And so there's no rule that says he has to seek such an opinion. But that's not the only ethics authority that's at issue here. Mr. Whitaker is no doubt a member of a bar, and as such subject to the disciplinary regulations of that bar as well. And it's quite feasible that somebody is thinking about a complaint to the bar council in, I assume, Iowa, which is where he's from, but who knows, as another means of compelling that inquiry to begin.
So I want to turn to Congress and specifically to the levers that exist in both houses of Congress realistically. The initial one I don't know which comes first because I don't know how long it's going to take the president to nominate an attorney general. But let's assume that the initial question is, what does the Senate allow the president to get away with in naming an attorney general? And the longer-term question is, what levers can the House committees, now going to be run by Democrats starting in January, leverage against the president to ensure that the investigation is protected? Steve, you've also argued very strongly for the protection of the passage of affirmative legislation to protect Mueller, which you raised earlier in the discussion. I want to start with you. What do you think is a powerful lever here? What are the strongest levers that we have in Congress, and which of those levers are and are not likely actually to be played in a useful way?
Well, I guess I'd start, Ben, with one of the ironies of last night's election results, which is that the president actually would probably have more latitude and more leeway with respect to naming a, you know, new permanent nominee to replace Jeff Sessions in the next Congress, where, you know, by all accounts, he will have either two or three, and perhaps, depending on how things go, even four more Republican votes than is true under the current Congress. So, you know, as of right now, I mean, even if we see an effort to confirm a successor in the lame duck, that gives a lot of power to Susan Collins, to Jeff Flake, to Bob Corker, some of whom are lame ducks themselves, to basically exert their ability to vote no, or at least to threaten to vote no, to ensure that the permanent successor is someone more moderate. So, you know, one of the ironies here, I think, is that the longer President Trump waits to name a successor, it's possible that, you know, all things being equal, the wider an array of people he could name. With regard to other levers, I mean, I think it's unrealistic to expect either the current House or the current Senate really to do anything between now and January 3rd, notwithstanding these calls from, you know, some senators today to pick back up the Special Counsel Independence and Integrity Act, S-2644, which already passed the Senate Judiciary Committee back in April. Even if somehow, you know, there's pressure on Leader McConnell to bring that bill to the floor of the Senate, I just don't see the House passing it between now and January 3rd. So to my mind, Ben, you know, the only lever between now and January is the sort of nasty things senators can say in public about what they will be looking for in the next attorney general, and the specter that if, you know, if a move is made against Mueller, that they may actually then push to pass the bill and or, you know, do something more drastic. I think all that changes on January 3rd. On January 3rd, you know, Jerry Nadler becomes chair of the House Judiciary Committee. Elijah Cummings becomes chair of the House Oversight Committee. And, you know, when that happens, I think the whole calculus changes, perhaps not so much from the perspective of which legislation will get through, but from the perspective of Congress's ability and, I think, as importantly, its inclination to aggressively conduct its own investigation. Adam Schiff becomes chair of the House Intelligence Committee. And so, you know, I think what we're going to see is, even if nothing happens to Special Counsel Mueller between now and January 3rd, a ratcheting up, I think, of subpoenas from the new House to the Trump administration and a series of court battles over what I assume will be pretty sustained and substantial efforts on the part of the Trump administration to resist those subpoenas, to, you know, frustrate them, to refuse to comply with them.
Susan, if Steve is right, then what that means is that the president has a window of time that's 2 months long in which he can get away with a lot. And you suggested earlier before we were recording that Whitaker may be a reflection of Trump operating in that window, that this is the moment where he can do something like that and get away with it. I'm curious, if you were whispering in the ear of members of Congress, what are the ways that, what are the vehicles they have other than sort of grumbling senatorial statements about, you know, warning, that actually have some deterrent possibility here?
I mean, this presumes a level of will that I think we just haven't seen from congressional Republicans. You know,
but I'm talking about Democrats too.
The obvious tools I think that they have at their disposal right now in terms of, in practical terms, you know, right, of course they could, you know, deny a quorum or refuse to pass any kind of appropriations bill. You can imagine all kinds of sort of really extreme measures that they might take, particularly in sort of a DOJ oversight capacity, something like that. I think in terms of sort of in practical terms, what they really can do and the card that they have to play in this particular period, and especially House Democrats have to play here, is to promise that there will be intensive investigations of what occurs in this period, because that is a message to anyone in the Justice Department who might be tempted to capitulate to pressure or circumvent any kind of regulations or do anything that is going to facilitate misconduct. And I want to be clear, I don't believe that there are ethics or that there are career officials that that have those impulses, but there are political officials, right? You can imagine any group of people. I think it's a pretty clear message to them that they better do everything by the book, because every minute of every day, starting 24 hours ago and through the next several weeks, is really, really going to be under a microscope. And I do think that that has a relatively strong deterrent effect, that at the very least, you're going to, you know, anyone who wants to do something to impede the Mueller investigation is going to be forced to operate in such a way that doesn't make the bad faith apparent, and they're going to have to abide by the rules. Now, you can still do a lot that I think is potentially damaging within those constraints, but you can do a lot less. And so if I had sort of one card to recommend they play, it's an admittedly incredibly weak one. I do think the passage of sort of a Mueller protection bill is the strongest sort of available messaging right now, even if it doesn't have necessarily a hugely significant legal impact. I just don't see that happening, frankly, because, it's sort of like the days after the Comey firing, this really cataclysmic event that you would expect to engender just, the co-equal branch rising up, and instead is sort of met with kind of some shrugs and, well, I guess we'll see who the next person is. And I really do think that we're seeing a repeat of that here.
All right, so we need to wrap up. We've already lost Paul, but I'm going to ask each of you for a brief wrap-up. What are you looking for over the next few weeks? What would be the good signs? What would be the danger signs? And what are the canaries in the coal mine for you? Bob, what's on your mind as you watch the events of the next few weeks?
Number one, whether it appears that Trump is prepared to escalate because he sees value in doing it now, including some political value to him in forcing the Democrats to do what they don't want to have to do here, immediately having attained the majority in the House. And secondly, I will be looking for the kind of response, and I think Susan is absolutely correct, the measured message-sending response, disciplined and focused, that the Democrats would send in answer to that.
Steve, how about you?
I mean, I had thought that the red line was removing Sessions, at least with regard to finally impelling Congress to pass the legislation Susan referred to, and to, do other sort of soft power things to try to basically, dare President Trump to not defy them. Honestly, I think now the question is, what happens with Mueller? I mean, there have been reports in various media organizations today that Donald Trump Jr. has been telling associates that he thinks he's being indicted shortly. If the next move is from Mueller and not Whitaker, I think that's a pretty good sign, even if it's not, a big headline move from Mueller. So I'm looking to see, what, if anything, we hear from the acting attorney general's office. I'm looking to see what, if anything, we hear from the special counsel. I'm looking at tomorrow's oral argument in the D.C. Circuit, which I think we ought not to sort of lose sight of as an important legal moment for the future of this investigation. The point at which I think I will join Susan in being deeply, deeply fearful for where things are going is the point at which it becomes clear that the replacement of Attorney General Sessions with Acting Attorney General Whitaker really is directly imperiling the special counsel's ability to actually conclude his work, and where it doesn't look like Congress is actually going to do anything about it. That could happen a lot sooner than I would have thought 12 hours ago, but I still don't think we're quite there yet.
Susan, what's your canary in the coal mine?
So my, and again, I I agree with Steve. I think we're already way past sort of the red lines and are already in really, really alarming territory. But if I'm looking for sort of signs that it's getting even worse, I think my canary is the same thing that it's been really since the earliest days of the Trump administration, and that's principled resignations. So we've seen a few, a smattering here and there, but actually, you know, sort of the high-level career officials at the Justice Department, a lot of them have sort of held the line, continued to sort of to do their work and to do it honorably. I do think that we are moving into a territory in which if sort of our worst fears started to materialize, I do think that we would see some high-profile resignations and potentially some resignations that were sort of publicly stated, you know, that this was sort of in protest. Certainly to see what happens to Rod Rosenstein and his sort of perception and signaling about what's going on. The thing I wish we had to look for was, you know, a sort of a strong congressional response. But I think we have to resign ourselves to a world in which that is just not the reality. And so we are not talking about branches of government checking one another. We are talking about the institutional mechanisms and strength and legitimacy of the executive branch to constrain and control itself. I have a lot of faith in that system, but I note that it wasn't designed to do this. And so, I do think that we are starting to put pressure on these institutions that, we're going to get past the breaking point.
Chuck, I'm going to give you the final word. As you look forward, what are you looking for? What are good signs and what are bad signs?
I think metaphorically speaking, there is a coal mine and there are canaries in it. I think Susan's right. I want to look at what senior career officials do over the next several weeks. And I'm particularly interested in what Rod Rosenstein and his very capable principal deputy, Ed O'Callaghan, do. Can they work with Matt Whitaker? Is he moving in a direction that they simply can't stomach? And if that's the case, that would worry me deeply. One of the things I said at the outset of this conversation is that there's a very strong gravitational pull within the Department of Justice toward norms and the rule of law. I've been a part of that institution for a long time, and I have a deep faith in it. But that gravitational pull right now is being severely tested. So I'm going to keep an eye, like Susan said, on senior officials in the department.
We are going to have to leave it there. This has been a special edition of the Lawfare podcast. As with all special editions of the Lawfare podcast, we don't have music that brings us in and out, but if we did, it would be performed by Sophia Yan. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Matt Kahn for audio engineering, to Susan, Chuck, Steve, Bob, and Paul for joining us on very short notice. As with all special editions of the Lawfare podcast, the audio quality will be a little bit variable. We apologize for that. People are joining us from all over the place. Listen, folks, if you value these podcasts, please give us a rating on whatever podcast distribution service you use. Share the special edition of the Lawfare podcast. Tweet it. Share it on Facebook. Tell people about it. That's how we get the word out about it. We don't advertise. We don't do all those things. We just have you. So with that, we are going to sign off and we will join you again. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.